Hi there, it's News Talk's Andrea Gilligan here.
We talk a lot about health, but your gut is where it all begins. A balanced gut can improve everything from your digestion and energy to your immune system and even your mood. That's why Simproof, Ireland's number one for gut health, is such a game changer. And right now, for Black Friday, you can get 25% off their live and active bacteria supplement. Each daily shot is packed with billions of friendly bacteria that actually reach your gut alive and start working to restore balance where it matters most. No capsules, no powders, just a refreshing, water-based drink in four great flavours. Take it first thing each morning, 10 minutes before food or drink, and start feeling the difference. A healthy gut supports your whole body, so don't miss 25% off Simproof's 12 and 4-week programmes now at simproof.ie. Now, enjoy the podcast.
Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Cullen.
Brought to you by PwC.
This is News Talk.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullen, and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. Coming up on today's show, with the 30th anniversary of divorce becoming legal in Ireland, we look at the financial and legal implications of deciding to separate. We ask, is cryptocurrency the new bellwether for problems in the stock market? Plus, Katie Balls, the Washington editor of The Times, tells us Trump's biggest problem is sitting in the data centres of Silicon Valley. You can email the show, takingstock@newstalk.com, or you can message me here on socials at Susan Hayes Cullerton. Now, I'm going to start off this week by explaining to you a term that I'm hearing over and over and over again in relation to this week's UK budget. Many commentators are pointing out that Rachel Reeves had greater fiscal headroom than expected. So what is that? Well, it's basically the room for manoeuvre she and her department had to increase spending. Now, in this case, the UK government spending is expected to reach an extra £11 billion by 2029 and 2030. And that's primarily to pay for a reversal in welfare cuts and lift a two-child welfare limit for families. So that fiscal headroom gave her the opportunity to go ahead and do that. Now, of course, she could have also used that headroom to cut taxes. And as we know, she didn't. She increased them over time or absorbed the impact of borrowing more. Now, you might hear a similar term called fiscal space. Basically means the same thing. Ultimately, it meant she had more scope to do the things the government saw fit in this budget. Now, today, we're looking at something that we rarely discuss: the economics of divorce and its financial realities, as this week marks the 30th anniversary of the divorce referendum in Ireland. When a marriage ends, the costs can pile up fast: losing a tax partner, finding new accommodation, setting up childcare, and suddenly paying single rates for everything from rent to utilities. So what does divorce really cost? And if you or somebody you care about is going through it, what are the microeconomic implications? So to explore that, I'm joined by Keith Walsh of Keith Walsh Solicitors and Nick Charalambos, Managing Director with Alpha Wealth. And Keith, I'm going to start with you. In 2023, the European country with the highest divorce rate per 100 marriages was Finland, with more than 55 divorces. And at the bottom of the list was our good selves, Ireland, with 15.5 divorces per 100 marriages. What are the biggest misconceptions you see from people who walk into your office?
I think the first one is that everybody thinks it may be a 50-50 split in terms of assets and income and pensions, which it certainly isn't always. The second one is that people believe that their entitlement to the assets or income of the other spouse ends the date they stop living together, and it most definitely isn't. In fact, it goes right up until the date you're divorced. Whereas in other countries, like in America and California in particular, the date you live separate and apart is significant, but it's not in Ireland. It's the date you're actually divorced. And then people are confused between the difference between a legal separation and a divorce quite a bit. And also they get confused about child maintenance and spousal maintenance. For example, spousal maintenance is taxable by the spouse who receives it, and the person who gives it gets tax relief, whereas there's no tax relief at all on child maintenance.
And I know I'm talking about an emotive topic, but it is important that I ask some practical questions. Like, what sort of complexity comes with divorce? How complex can it get?
Well, from a financial point of view, it can get very complex. For example, if somebody's working in Microsoft or other American companies where you have share options, so you might have vested shares, unvested shares, unallocated shares, and you're trying to work out, well, look, what is that share portfolio like? It can get very complicated if somebody's working in a family business and there may be all kinds of commercial agreements in place. There may be blind trusts, there may be discretionary trusts. So you can have a complexity in terms of trusts, in terms of companies, in terms of businesses, in terms of pensions as well. Trying to work out what the value of a defined benefit pension is not that easy compared to maybe a PRSA, which has different advantages. So there's quite a complexity to the financial aspect of it. And then there's a complexity to dealing with people's emotions and when they're maybe not at their best. And sometimes you just have to say to people, look, you're not ready to deal with it. Let's leave it a couple of months and pick it up. And sometimes when you're acting for the person who maybe was aware before the other partner that the relationship was going to be over, that person is maybe 6 months or a year ahead of the other spouse. And to be fair, you have to give somebody a chance to catch up. And also when you're dealing with children. So most money things can be resolved, but you can't go back and change what's happened with children. So generally, most people going through a separation or divorce realise that and try and resolve it and do the best they can for the children, whether it's financially or being reasonable with the other person. In most cases, people actually want to be reasonable and want to resolve their divorce. And a bit of good financial advice and planning can really help that in terms of the value of a pension, in terms of taking maybe stock options, or in terms of what is best for me. Should I take cash now? Should we sell the house? Should we hold on? You know, it gets more complex when there's a portfolio of assets and you might have capital gains tax, or where you haven't been living in the family home for a long time and you've been renting. How should that be treated in the overall settlement?
And Nick, Ireland has around 7 divorces per 10,000 people. And I know in your own case, you're one of them. And can you tell us from your own experience, as well as working with clients going through it, what are the first things that people should think about financially when separation comes on the horizon?
Absolutely, Susan. And look, I agree with all of the comments that Keith has made, and they're very sound comments that he did make. But having gone through the process myself about 7 years ago, and subsequently I've got remarried. But the key things really that I say to individuals, and again, it's something I went through myself, is that it's important to have your own kind of financial independence to a point that, you know, I speak to many people and we all have different ways of dealing with our own finances. It might be that we have a joint account, perhaps with our partner. We might have a separate account for ourselves. And I think certainly when it comes to separation, having the ability to be able to access money in your own name, I think is really important. So that's general financial kind of planning, really. But, you know, you don't want to rely on the fact that you might have a joint account that perhaps, you know, if your partner or spouse, you know, feels that they want to take money from that account, it can create a lot more problems, especially if things aren't always, you know, harmonious, which unfortunately they sometimes won't be. The other thing then is to sort of try and get a sense of, and as Keith says, it's not going to be a quick process. I think sometimes we all maybe quite emotional and think that these things can be dealt with, you know, almost overnight. But unfortunately, they do take a while, and maybe being able to kind of think slightly longer term around the implications of certain assets, for example, the family home tends to be, you know, obviously one of the biggest assets that people have, but there are others such as pensions and so on. And realizing that, okay, in general, you know, if it is a case that the two parties are essentially, you know, working, earning a similar amount, there might be some kind of equalization of the way those assets are spread. But as Keith has alluded to, that may or may not transpire. And there may be a difference between one spouse and the other. And that can obviously lead to, you know, different percentages that may be allocated, and people may have different wishes. So again, I think it's a really difficult topic insofar as every divorce is different. Some people, you know, may go down obviously the route of arbitration. Some may be able to, you know, agree things themselves, and some unfortunately end up, you know, in the courts, and that in itself can be quite an expensive, obviously, situation. And particularly when there are children involved, it does add that further layer of complexity, because obviously it's really important to make sure that the children are not only looked after financially, but obviously from a point of view of obviously you know, how the arrangements are between two parents and who has access and so on and so forth. So there are a number of different moving parts. But the one thing I'd say to any of the listeners is that, you know, it's a process that I went through. I had a particularly difficult time, but, you know, there is light at the end of the tunnel. And I think sometimes getting appropriate advice, either be it from, you know, a family member, just to even be able to speak to someone, I think is really important. It might be a friend. And from a professional, from a legal standpoint, and even from a financial standpoint, it could help. You know, there are agencies available such as MABS. Obviously, there's financial planners, people like myself, who sometimes can create, you know, that division insofar as being able to talk to maybe both parties. And, you know, finance is a topic that I think generally as a nation, we find it difficult to talk about at the best of times. And don't mind if we're going through that. So,
and you're right on that, indeed, because nobody goes into a marriage expecting it to not continue after all, Nick. But Keith, can I pick up on a point that you've made there about people not knowing the difference between a separation and a divorce? But actually, if I go further than that, there's also the difference between just living apart and being formally separated. In 2020, there was a legal change reducing the living apart period from 4 years to 2 years in order to get a divorce. Could you walk us through the difference between simply living apart and, even if that's under the same roof, being legally separated and being divorced?
So living apart just means that you're usually living in separate bedrooms. You can be under the same roof, but you're not, for example, sharing meals. You may be just together for the purposes of the optics for the children. So there's no real legal, legal significance of that. You're still married. When you're legally separated, what that does is it draws a line in the sand, and you usually have a full and final settlement clause so that if you get divorced, the legal separation is upheld. It's not guaranteed it will be, but it's very likely it would be. So having a legal separation makes a huge difference. And again, once you get legally separated, usually you do that because you don't have the 2 years apart for divorce. So if you're living separate and apart for 2 years, you can get divorced. The only reason you would get legally separated is if you're not living apart for 2 years.
And why would you get divorced if you're already legally separated?
Because you can remarry, and because it kind of prevents people maybe getting a second bite of the cherry. Everything in theory can be revisited on divorce, even if you're legally separated. But there's case law that says the less time between a legal separation and a divorce, and if there's no great change in circumstances, it's exceptionally unlikely there'd be any change in the terms of your legal separation. So for certainty, that's why people do it.
But what would be great changes in circumstances? Is that not very subjective?
No. The court, again, the High Court has a couple of decisions on it, and the case law is maybe somebody who's got a catastrophic injury, maybe if you've lost your job and you can't get another one. Things that wouldn't maybe count as significant changes is if you got a significant amount of money and you invested it poorly or unwisely. That maybe wouldn't be one, but it would depend on the circumstances. So you're talking about major life events, you know, winning the lottery, really very significant life events. So things that you would recognise as very unusual.
Infrequent, I'm sure.
And infrequent. Yeah. So again, so legally separated is the same as getting divorced, except you can't get remarried. But on divorce, a judge can, in theory, revisit everything. So everybody who's legally separated should make sure they get divorced, because that kind of closed the door and bolted it. In theory, you can get revisit in very unusual circumstances if you're divorced, but it's now much more difficult to do that than it was even 10, 15 years ago, because there's been a number of cases.
And Nick, again, I need to speak practically here in this conversation too, because some partners in a relationship may not have a utility bill in their own name, or they may not know who to call or like what to look up when it comes to certain financial affairs. Like Keith there was referring to a PRSA, but if they don't know who the PRSA provider is, or if they're unaware of unvested shares, or if they don't know who to talk to, what practical steps should they take early on, or as early on as possible, to protect themselves?
Yeah, that's a good point, Susan. And I think part of the financial kind of education for all of us, whether there's a marriage that may be dissolved or even in, you know, healthy marriages, I think it's important that we understand, you know, what assets we have, what liabilities. I always encourage clients to do kind of a financial budgeter at least once a year. We all get to a point, perhaps maybe in January, where we're trying to kind of, I suppose, start the year on a positive and, you know, kickstart things. So, and I know it may not be the most interesting or exciting topic, but I think it helps us even to rationalize in our own minds, you know, what accounts do we have? Can we get in touch with our pension provider to find out what the value of our pension is and where it's invested, or if we have a pension through our employment, just to get an update and even just jot it down somewhere on a piece of paper or a spreadsheet so that we kind of recognize, you know, what money we do have. Because there is always this fear, you know, people sometimes feel that they don't have any money, even though, you know, they may have some monies in accounts that they forgot about and, you know, be able to get their hands on. I accept that whilst some couples may have one partner who's very organized and then someone that may not even know where there are certain assets held or investments and so on. And generally speaking, you know, when there is a separation, you do rely on, to a certain degree, honesty from both parts. Obviously, if it gets to a point that, again, Keith would be more expert in this than I, but, you know, you are asked to fill in kind of what's known as an affidavit of means. So it's literally like putting down all of your assets. And in some cases, you know, it may not be as accurate as it needs to be. And that's not always deliberately bad-minded on the part of the spouse. As Keith says, there are certain situations where, you know, it's almost impossible to find out absolute values. But the main thing really is that I think we all owe it to ourselves that, you know, we know what money we have. We can get hands to a certain degree. And I would encourage any listeners to say, well, do you have your own kind of financial independence to a point? Do you have an account that you can get hold of for, you know, your own self, rather than, because sometimes we find that, you know, people can feel a little bit restricted, you know, and again, it's not always deliberate, but they may feel over-reliant on their partner financially. And that can cause quite a lot of issues, particularly in a breakdown of a marriage, because they feel very, very alone and, you know, they don't know where to turn. As I mentioned earlier, you know, there are agencies available. MABS would be one that certainly would be available for all individuals to be able to get some guidance from, being able to reach out to, you know, a financial advisor. There are many advisors that will provide a certain level of advice. And really just finding out what your options are and trying to think about, you know, financially what would make sense to you. You know, obviously, if you, you know, want to retain the family home, I think it's really important just to have that, you and know, always kind of front and center.
I just want to make sure that I just ask one last question here, because it is quite an emotive one. But Keith, I can imagine that going through a divorce is emotionally grueling, and wanting a quiet life or guilt that has arisen can lead people to make decisions that may not make sense in the long term. What's the danger in that? And in 30 seconds, how do you guide clients towards something that's truly fair and sustainable, and picking up on Nick's point in the context of honesty as well?
The first thing is get legal advice as early as you can in the process. It'll be money well spent, because you can go off and do other things, but at least if you know your rights straight away, you know what you should be getting in terms of disclosure of assets and how you should measure what you're likely to get. A good family lawyer will always give you a range of options and what is good, what is not good, and what is terrible, and then what is very good. Get that range on your first legal consultation. Get your legal consultation done. Find out what financial information you need to get. Also, there are warning signs if somebody's maybe being coercively controlled, or if there's economic, you know, kind of bullying going on where people don't have access to bank accounts and other things. You can't really resolve things properly if you don't have oversight of all the finances. And that's a big warning sign for anyone. If you can't put your hand on your heart and say, look, I have a good idea what the finances are, you can't really enter into a settlement, a mediated one, an arbitrated one, or even a lawyer-assisted one. So the first thing is to find out.
And of course, as well, though, the point is that may not be the person who spots it, but a loved one who spots it in somebody else.
Or an advisor, like your lawyer should spot it straight away for you.
So I really appreciate you both coming in. It's a very important conversation, and the inspiration for today's conversation actually came from, I was speaking at an event around financial literacy, and a woman came up to me afterwards and she said, rarely do people talk about people who are either going through a divorce, or again, those who are supporting those who are going through it. So I really appreciate your time today, Keith Walsh of Keith Walsh Solicitors, and Nick Charalambos, Managing Director with Alpha Wealth. This is Susan Hayes Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we ask, what Bitcoin's woes tell us about the wider market?
Hi there, it's News Talk's Andrea Gilligan here. This Black Friday, Mars Pharmacy is making wellness simple, and the savings are seriously impressive. It's the perfect time to look after your health from the inside out, starting with 25% off Simprove, the award-winning water-based supplement packed with billions of live and active bacteria to support gut balance, digestion and immunity. Because a healthy gut really does mean a healthier you. You can also save up to 35% on Zuki's liposomal vitamins, from collagen to vitamin C. They're your daily boost for glowing skin and immune support. And if you're plant-based, there's 25% off Dr. Vegan, bringing clean, effective nutrition with zero compromise. From gut health to glowing skin, Mars has everything you need to feel your best this winter. Shop these Black Friday wellness deals and more in-store or online now at mars.ie. Now, enjoy the podcast.
Hey football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8-6-25 and 1-5-26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
You've finally broken loose from work. Three friends, one tea time, and then the text. Honey, there's water in the basement. Not exactly how you pictured your Saturday. That's when you call us, Cincinnati Insurance. We always answer the call, because real protection means showing up, even when things are in the rough. Cincinnati Insurance. Let us make your bad day better. Find an agent at CINFIN.com.
Welcome back to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes-Cullerton. Now, for this week's trivia, I was in a city recently that has an observatory that was established in 1790, a planetarium that opened in 1968, has two St. Patrick's cathedrals, and a castle that was featured in the Game of Thrones. Which city was I in? And I will give you the answer at the end of the show. Well, as we hurtle towards the end of the year, many market watchers are asking, will there be a crash or a correction? And maybe we can get some clues from the cryptocurrency market. But to help us do that, I'm joined by Katie Martin, markets columnist at the FT. And first of all, Katie, I don't want to conflate Bitcoin with all of the crypto market, as it often gets more elaborate as the years go on. So to get us started, can you give us a quick explainer, please, of how Bitcoin is an example of a cryptocurrency, please?
So Bitcoin is the biggie, right? There's thousands of these coins out there that are invented to represent all sorts of different things. But Bitcoin is kind of the original and best, if you like. It's kind of like the benchmark, the sort of Jupiter in the crypto system. So that's the one that drives the most attention. And generally speaking, you know, there is a little bit of kind of movement either side. But generally speaking, whichever way Bitcoin goes, the rest of the crypto market will go to.
Ah, so it's not just, as we'll get on to, a predictor of the stock market, it's a predictor of the crypto market too.
Yeah, absolutely. It just has, because it's so much bigger than the others, it just has this really sort of strong, what's the word I'm looking for, like gravitational pull on the rest of the market.
And also, I just also want to make sure that we're very clear, Bitcoin is the cryptocurrency, blockchain is the technology that underpins it.
Yes, exactly. So you can use blockchain technologies to do all sorts of different things. But that's where Bitcoin lives, and all the different sorts of crypto coins use different sorts of blockchains. But really, a lot of the differences between those little blockchains are not worth spending too much brain power trying to understand. The point is they use a form of technology that's been kicking around for about 15, 16, 17 years. And these coins, some of them were invented, you know, last night or last year or whatever. But Bitcoin's been around for a really long time.
Now, the reason we're talking today, though, Katie, is you wrote a piece where you said you think Bitcoin is becoming a predictor of what's coming in the broader stock market. A really interesting piece that you wrote in the FT. Can you just walk us through your rationale for that, please?
Yeah, so when you think about it, if you have stocks, for example, in the stock market, you know, each stock represents a tiny little chunk of a company that's been cut into tiny pieces and put on a stock market. And if you look at things like bonds, so government bonds, that's ways that governments have to borrow money in public markets. And each individual bond is kind of an IOU from the government. Bitcoin isn't linked to anything. It's not linked to a company. It won't pay you out a dividend. It doesn't make any promises about what it's going to do next. So if you buy it, you buy it purely as a form of speculation, purely really as an idea that you think someone else is going to be willing to buy it off you at a later date at a higher price. So it's very much speculation, pretty much for its own sake. Now, I will get angry emails about this because I know a lot of true believers in crypto, a lot of true believers in Bitcoin think that this is a new form of money or that it's a new foundation of the financial system. I'm yet to see a huge, you know, a significant amount of evidence for that yet. So for now, it's a pure way of speculating. And it that sort of makes it the bleeding edge, the leading edge, if you like, of a sign of how enthusiastic investors are much more broadly for buying into risky assets. So that's why of late, quite a few times, we've seen periods where the Bitcoin price drops and then stock markets follow, which is quite an interesting phenomenon and not really something that we're super used to.
Okay. Now, if I challenge that assumption, though, that we'll say Bitcoin as an example of the biggest cryptocurrency. Could I challenge the idea that the reason that one is now leading the other is because quite simply crypto and particularly Bitcoin with it has simply moved mainstream, like BlackRock and Fidelity now have exchange traded funds where one can track the price of it. So I could buy those funds with a view to tracking the price of Bitcoin without actually buying Bitcoin at all. The market cap of Bitcoin is now in $1 trillion territory, with a lot of volatility, but there nonetheless. And we see Harvard and the Czech Central Bank stocking up on digital tokens. So yes, it's a risky asset, but is it now just mainstream? And that's why the correlation has increased.
Well, $1 trillion, sure, don't get me wrong, it's a lot of money, more than I get paid in a year. But, you know, you look at something like NVIDIA, the big chips company.
Which is worth $5 trillion now.
Mm-hmm. That's a $5 trillion company all by itself. The overall US stock market is many, many multiples bigger than the entirety of the crypto market. So it is edging into the mainstream in the sense that you can take exposure as an investor, whether that's as a retail investor like you and me, or whether you're a big institution. You can take exposure to crypto through instruments that are managed by big professional companies like BlackRock. But I think it's a little bit of a stretch to say it's made it to the big time. You know, there's still a lot of speculative froth about this. There's still a lot of kind of excitement about not very much. So it's making it towards the mainstream, but I don't think it's quite there yet for me. You know, and I know that people feel very, very differently about crypto and people feel very strongly about crypto. But for me, it's not quite at the center of the system yet. You know, when I talk to really big, serious investors who manage things like My Pension and Yours and who manage serious pots of money for governments around the world, they're not talking about Bitcoin. They're talking about bonds. They're talking about stocks. They're talking about other traditional assets. Now, some of those assets haven't done as well as crypto has in the past few years. But nonetheless, if you're a big institutional investor, you generally want more underpinnings to the things that you're buying than you can currently get from Bitcoin.
Okay. And let's follow that argument through then, because we have seen a really significant decline in the price of Bitcoin, particularly in October. It has been exacerbated again in November. And particularly over the past week, there's headlines every day about what's going on with people dumping digital tokens and so on. So if we were to take the decline in Bitcoin's price and compare that to what's going on in the stock market at the moment, what message do you heed?
Well, what I'm seeing from that is, look, Bitcoin had an absolutely terrific run after the re-election of Donald Trump, right, just over a year ago, because he's a crypto-friendly president. His family are involved in lots of different crypto projects. So the price of Bitcoin absolutely rocketed. And by actually October this year, it had made it as high as like $125 a piece. You know, this is $125,000 a piece. So this is an absolutely phenomenal run that crypto has had. But since then, it kind of hit a wall. It ran out of a bit of steam. It fell down to as low as just over $80,000 a piece last week. So it's a pretty significant drop. And if you were one of the people who was unfortunate enough to buy it at the top, then you've lost 27% of the value of that investment. Now, what has triggered that? You know, as I was saying, because Bitcoin isn't linked to the performance of a company or to the debt dynamics of a country or anything like that, it's quite difficult to say what really moves it. But it feels like it just kind of got swept higher by this wave of enthusiasm that was running all the way through markets, from everything to stocks in artificial intelligence, to the crypto sector, to quantum computing, to all sorts of different things. There was a really big jump in asset prices for lots of different speculative areas of the market. And, you know, experience tells me, having looked at markets for a number of years, that these things don't tend to move in a straight line, and that momentum does run momentum runs out of momentum. It runs out of steam at a certain point. And then you do get what investors call drawdowns, where the price falls pretty significantly. Now, will it come back? Possibly. You know, I've predicted the Bitcoin price will fall numerous times and been wrong numerous times. But it has had a significant drop. Now, one of the reasons why that might be a little bit more durable, this drop this time around, is there's lots of companies out there that call themselves Bitcoin treasury companies. And really all they do for a living is buy Bitcoin and with borrowed money and hold on to that Bitcoin and hope the price will go up. And there's lots of these things that are listed on stock markets. Certainly there's a few in the UK, there's loads of them in the States. And when Bitcoin prices start to fall, some of them become what we call forced sellers. So they have to get out because suddenly the value of all their investments is falling quite quickly, and that can be harmful to their share price. So some of them may be getting out of those Bitcoin that they've bought. So that might make this a little bit more of a durable pullback in the Bitcoin price. But, you know, as I say, people who love this stuff will swear that it's going to $1 million a piece and will buy the dip.
Let's look at that, though, because they say the people who make money in a gold rush is not those who buy gold, but those who buy shovels and or sell shovels, I should say. So if we look at Coinbase, which is a cryptocurrency stockbroker type, its share price is down 25% since it literally listed on the stock market. And we've seen the iShares Bitcoin Trust ETF that has recorded $2.2 billion in outflows this month, 8 times the losses that it experienced in October. And it's the second worst month on record since its debut in early 2024. Do you see these then as opportunities, or is this, as you say, the momentum coming out of momentum?
Look, I'm not here to give people investment advice, and it really does depend on your viewpoint on how meaningful you think Bitcoin as an investment is and blockchain technology is. But, you know, you piece all of these things together. Some of the listings haven't gone very well. Some of the Bitcoin treasury companies are falling over. The price of Bitcoin has fallen very significantly. For now, it feels like, you know, some of this party is over. We had this huge wash of excitement after Donald Trump got re-elected, and maybe that's just reached its natural end, because you need, for the price of Bitcoin to go up, you need to keep finding fresh buyers. And if that becomes difficult for whatever reason, then you can see quite significant pullbacks in the price. So, you know, like I say, I've thought, okay, this is it. It's all over for Bitcoin a number of times when, you know, exchanges have fallen over. People have gone to prison for fraud relating to it. China has tried to clamp down on the mining of Bitcoin. Various authorities around the world have imposed restrictions on buying Bitcoin. And each time I've thought, okay, this really could be significant. This could be the thing that really pulls the value of this investment down. And it's not happened. And that's because there are an awful lot of people out there in the world who perfectly reasonably completely disagree with me and think that this is transformational technology and a life-changing investment. And the other thing about it, I will just quickly say, is that, you know, Although I don't see the rationale personally for investing in this stuff, I know that it has made people life-changing amounts of money, and it's been fantastic for their personal financial situations. And I wish them nothing but luck with that. You know, great work.
And as you say, though, Katie, this fundamentally is something that is only driven by the perspective of people buying and selling it. It's not driven by earnings of a company or by the dynamics of a bond. So therefore, the only thing that makes this valuable is that other people feel that it's valuable too. Before you go, since we have the chance to talk to somebody with the word on the street, what is the local reaction to Rachel Reeves' budget when she took to the dispatch box earlier on this week?
Look, if you politically really like Rachel Reeves, then you think it was fantastic. And if you politically really hate her, then you think it was dreadful. And she's getting monstered in some parts of the press, and she's getting lauded in others. But ultimately, the budget that the Chancellor delivered kind of doesn't change that much. She's raised an awful lot in taxes, which some people are obviously uncomfortable with, but she's also raised spending on the other side of the ledger. So it's not as if the UK is really balancing its books here. But the really good news, as far as I'm concerned, because I'm a markets person, I write about markets for a living, is that she has not set fire to the markets like Liz Truss did in 2022, because none of us want a repeat of that. So, you know, the Chancellor and her team worked really hard to understand what is it that bond investors are looking for, how far can we push the market, how can we avoid pushing it over. And I think, you know, whatever you think of the politics and whatever side of the tax and spending you're on, and however much it hurts you personally financially, I think we can all be glad that she has not set fire to the bond market and sent our borrowing costs through the roof, because we had that experience a few years ago and it was extremely painful.
I remember it well. Thank you so much indeed for joining us, Katie Martin, markets columnist at the FT.
Pleasure.
This is Susan A's Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk, and up next, the Trump AI bubble.
Hi there, it's News Talk's Andrea Gilligan here. We talk a lot about health, but your gut is where it all begins. A balanced gut can improve everything from your digestion and energy to your immune system and even your mood. That's why Simproof, Ireland's number one for gut health, is such a game changer. And right now, for Black Friday, you can get 25% off their live and active bacteria supplement. Each daily shot is packed with billions of friendly bacteria that actually reach your gut alive and start working to restore balance where it matters most. No capsules, no powders, just a refreshing, water-based drink in four great flavours. Take it first thing each morning, 10 minutes before food or drink, and start feeling the difference. A healthy gut supports your whole body, so don't miss 25% off Simproof's 12 and 4-week programmes now at simproof.ie. Now, enjoy the podcast.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8-6-25 and 1-5-26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
You've finally broken loose from work. Three friends, one tea time, and then the text. Honey, there's water in the basement. Not exactly how you pictured your Saturday. That's when you call us, Cincinnati Insurance. We always answer the call, because real protection means showing up, even when things are in the rough. Cincinnati Insurance. Let us make your bad day better. Find an agent at CINFIN.com.
Welcome back to Taking Stock here on News Talk. I'm Susan A's Cullerton. Well, earlier in the show, you heard me talking about how a drop in the price of Bitcoin may be foreshadowing a wider fall in stocks, which could turn into a full-scale crash. Now, fueling these fears is the worry that stocks associated with AI are overvalued and entering bubble territory. With President Trump hoping his economic plans will be turbocharged by AI, any falls may land the US economy in big trouble heading into the 2026 midterm elections. Now, what might that mean? Well, I'm delighted to be joined by Katie Balls, the Washington editor of The Times and Sunday Times. And Katie, I read your piece with interest this week, and one point that you made jumped right out at me. AI-related capital spending contributed more than consumer spending to US GDP for the first time. Now, Katie, what message does that convey? Or more importantly, what does it mask?
Well, I think it just shows how reliant the US economy and within that Donald Trump's political fortunes and plan are on the AI industry. And therefore, as you just touched on, you have a situation where, you know, there's lots of talk about a potential AI bubble, the sense that these companies are, you know, investing much in one another. Is the bubble going to burst? People compare it to the railways in the 19th century in America. You also hear about the dot-com bubble. And if it is the case, then that is a big problem, because if you strip out what we've seen in terms of the AI boom, there's not much in terms of US growth, and the economy starts to look quite tricky.
Okay, but when you focus particularly on growth, let's just look at the earnings there now in particular, because you talk about three different risks in the piece, and it's really well articulated. And the first one is that big tech has gone from being 22% of the S&P 500 to now almost, 22% back in 2022. And now it's gone up to almost a third. And yet, Katie, if you look at these companies' share of net profits of the index, they haven't changed. So are we really looking at a rise in investor expectations into meteoric levels, and yet we're wondering really where the return on investment is coming from?
Yeah, I think potentially we are. And as I say in the piece, when it comes to the fact that big tech now accounts for almost a third of the S&P 500, I mean, politically and obviously coming from Washington, D.C., where I'm reporting on, it does mean that Donald Trump is hostage to quite a narrow slice of Silicon Valley. And therefore, when you're, looking at what we expect will need to happen here, which is Trump needs its shares to keep soaring. You obviously have Americans particularly who look at their stocks, but then the voters not rich enough to own this start to feel a bit poorer. So he ends up in a bit of a catch-22. But as you say, the expectation is that these shares will keep soaring and keep going up. And that's a hope.
But the thing is, I was in Washington myself a couple of weeks ago, Katie, and more I'm hearing the discussion about the K-shaped economy in the US. So when you talk about the people who can't afford to invest, not alone are they feeling higher prices in the grocery store, they're also seeing the opportunity cost. And I know that's a technical term, but they're also feeling what they're not feeling by benefiting from the stock market as well. So is there a double whammy for the bottom half of the K?
Exactly. And also, particularly when you think about the early days of the Donald Trump second term, when the tariffs were coming through and you had lots of stock market jitters, of course. And you had Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, saying, you know, we're for K Street, not for Wall Street. But you look at what's happening with AI and what's happening with the stocks. And I think there is a creeping concern amongst Republicans and Donald Trump supporters that some of the, you know, the working people, the blue collar workers are meant to, represent, that they brought on in this MAGA movement, are not feeling the benefit of this. And if it goes this way, we could continue to feel particularly isolated. And you mentioned affordability. Since the elections earlier this month, which saw, you had the mayor in New York, but you also had governorship races in Virginia, where you had the Democrats really having a clean sweep. I think there are concerns that affordability is just becoming such an issue. And we're speaking over Thanksgiving. But you look, for example, even at McDonald's, right? Donald Trump recently spoke at a McDonald's event talking about how he's tackling inflation. But, you know, just a few weeks before, the chief executive of McDonald's has said that in America, they are seeing that lower income workers are moving away from the fast food chain because it's just becoming too pricey for them. It's less of a problem for McDonald's because they're making up as the high earners who now have more disposable income. So they're going to McDonald's instead. But it does slightly point to what is happening in terms of the unevenness.
Well, let's keep pulling that thread there when it comes to affordability, because the second risk that you highlight is the impact of AI on the cost of living. So you say the power to run data centers, grid updates and increased costs for natural gas has helped push the US household electricity bill up by 30%. Now, Katie, how does one translate into the other?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting story in America that is creeping up the news agenda, but, we're still getting some information. So effectively, for the AI revolution to be a success, they need a lot of electricity to power data centers. Now, feeding them takes a lot of energy, and that is now being reflected in bills. So you can look at, there's different stats you can look at. So for example, you know, the average US household electricity bill is up by about 30% over the past 4 years. You can't put that all on AI, but certainly power data centers are seen to be one of the factors, along with grid updates, increased cost of natural gas. But then you look at specific parts of the country. So, you know, where data centers are concentrated. So the PJM grid region is a particular area, and they have found, you know, it's Illinois to North Carolina. Capacity market costs are now close to a tenfold rise over 2 years. And that is mostly blamed on data center demand. So lots of communities are potentially facing their bills rising faster than inflation. And that's partly to fund these supercomputers. You are getting, you know, more kind of local people speaking out about this in the areas where they're most affected. And if the rollout keeps going, that's going to become, you know, a much wider issue. And again, clearly energy is a huge part of cost of living.
Oh, huge part. And as we all know, the two most volatile parts of inflation is food and energy. People feel it, and they feel it every time they see a bill. But what I find interesting about this conversation about a bubble is ordinarily we talk about what would go wrong if the bubble bursts. But in this case, you also raise the issue of, well, what happens if it goes right? In other words, what if AI really does go on to be a huge success and it takes away a range of jobs? And for example, this week we've seen Hewlett Packard announcing that it's now, that it can cut up to 10% of its workforce due to AI. What would be the impact, do you think, of, and across America, not just looking towards the midterms, but beyond, if it is the case that AI does move on and sweeps up an awful lot of jobs?
Well, it could obviously be very painful. And I think at the moment, there are some figures in the administration, so the Trump administration, for example, J.D. Vance, who are quite positive and bullish when it comes to the AI revolution. And some in MAGA say, actually, this is a good way to reduce the need on immigration, but we're going to empower American workers. But right now, I don't think that is the sense of the country when you look at polling in terms of how the public feels about what AI may do to their jobs. Instead, there's a lot of fear that AI is coming for their jobs. It's not about to create a new wave. So if it starts to take some jobs away, the question is, what do you replace them with? And we haven't quite got the answer yet. And I think particularly having spoken to, you know, various figures for this article, I think there's a concern about ultimately younger workers perhaps being the most negatively affected in the short term. Because if you look at, you know, what college grads, you know, entering in terms of the workforce, whether it's HR, coding, these are kind of the areas where already there's some data in the US suggesting that that's where there's fewer opportunities, partly because of AI. You're able to have these shortcuts. You don't need to have some of these more administrative menial tasks that might be your beginner point. But yet, there's nothing there to replace it. And then, of course, you go back to, you know, these industrial towns that the, you know, Trump administration really made inroads within the campaign. These people who feel left behind. Well, if they think these jobs are being taken by automation and AI, what is the replacement? And I think, therefore, yes, the midterms, but also going into 2028, if it feels as though, you know, that AI is a bigger threat, and potentially, and as you say, the AI bubble, if it works, could take away these jobs. You could also have a situation where AI, the bubble begins to burst, but also these jobs are being taken in some parts. And then it's almost the worst of all situations. And we are seeing also within the Republican base, you know, there is already pushback from some of the grassroots towards the Trump administration's approach to AI for some of these reasons. You have MAGA figures like Steve Bannon, Marjorie Taylor Greene, the congresswoman who's recently said she's stepping down after falling out with the president, saying, hang on a minute, we think that the administration is moving too fast with AI, siding with the tech giants, and not thinking about some of the risks to the communities, both in terms of jobs, but also in terms of, you know, what does this technology do on child protection, child safety, and so forth.
One of the things, Katie, as well, that comes up around this conversation is, of course, the world is considering, are we actually in an AI bubble? But I think if we look at a subset of that, it's the circuitous payments are particularly curious. So OpenAI is paying $300 billion to Oracle for computing capacity. Oracle is paying tens of billions to NVIDIA for chips to install at OpenAI's data centres. And NVIDIA is investing $100 billion in AI as it deploys chips. Like, what's really going on here? And what is the risk, of course, of these circuitous type of payments as well?
Oh, completely. And this is a concern, which is these companies are potentially artificially inflating, obviously, the value of their stocks if there's just a circular flow of investments. And perhaps it's, we all succeed together or we all die together.
Or a domino effect if one goes down.
Well, quite. And therefore, it was interesting last week when you had, Wall Street really jittery in the week, stocks falling. Then NVIDIA, one of the largest $5 trillion valuation coming out and posting, better than expected profits, better than expected figures, which led, which I think, the implication was, why is everyone talking about a bubble? Look at this great company. Everyone should be a bit quiet. But it only really had a brief rally. And then the next day it was back to, stock sliding and concern. So it clearly didn't do enough to satisfy. But all these companies naturally have an interest in speaking positively about the other and propping it up. And that's, it doesn't necessarily, I think, answer all the concerns that people have going forward. I think there's also a point, which is, you look at some of these big tech companies, which, do prop up the economy. Some of them have different things. Google, Microsoft, Meta, they will have different sources of revenue. And ones like OpenAI, I think people do think are particularly bubbly just because they are more one-sided in terms of what they're doing and therefore more reliant.
But the thing, though, Katie, that I'm intrigued by, right, is that OpenAI could go public for as much as $1 trillion and it's loss-making. And this could be the largest IPO in history. Like, what is the message of that?
The expectation is that AI is something you can monetize, of course, and, make a lot of money from in the long term. But that's obviously one of the things here, which is we haven't quite seen that yet. So, it is betting on the fact that, yes, this technology keeps coming, but also there's a way to suddenly monetize that in a sense that if we look at the evidence so far, it doesn't quite come to that. So I think that is the big question for a company like AI, OpenAI.
And, well, if we, as we come to the end of our conversation, I want to bring it down to a binary answer if I can on this one. So I could find plenty of people who would argue we're not in an AI bubble because the Mag 7, the Magnificent Seven, are making really big profits, and particularly NVIDIA is making real money from AI, and we could see that in the earnings calls, like you mentioned. On the other hand, I could find another school of thought who would argue the PE ratios of the tech firms are too high. Much of the investment into AI isn't generating any sort of a decent return yet. So in order to discern whether we're in an AI bubble or not, what are you looking at?
So I think on this one, look, everyone's going to have the different figures that they're looking at in terms of the stocks and so forth. You have companies, which I think we've spoken about. You can't take the endorsement of one or the other necessarily to tell you because they're all tied up in one another. I think it's probably just seeing how in the next couple of months and years, yes, the stocks, but also, are they finding a way to show that all this investment leads to something in the way of returns? And I think, obviously, I'm coming this more as a perspective of a political journalist based here in DC. And I think, the White House is now so invested in this AI revolution being a success. You can see that in the fact it's listed in its, five economic priorities in terms of what they're doing. There is an argument that, there is no choice but to embrace the AI revolution if you think about what China is doing on chips, if you think about national security. I think the risk is it the case that the US economy's eggs are all effectively in one basket when it comes to what we're looking at? And that is what is making, I think, some people here in Washington, D.C. and all the way to Silicon Valley a little bit nervous.
Well, Katie, this is a topic I'm sure we'll talk about again and again as we move into 2026. Thanks so much for joining us here on Taking Stock. Katie Balls, the Washington editor of The Times and The Sunday Times. Now, for the answer to this week's trivia, I told you that I was in a city recently that had an observatory that was established in 1790, a planetarium that opened in 1968, two St. Patrick's cathedrals, and a castle that featured in the Game of Thrones. Which city was I in? Well, the answer is Armagh. And I was indeed in it last week, but there's another reason why I picked it for today's show. Earlier on in the week, it was my father-in-law, Tommy Colliton's anniversary. Now, unfortunately, I never got to meet him as he died before I met my husband, Ardal. But he had a profound effect in my life in bringing the young man into the world who I would go on to marry. And Tommy was born in Armagh, so that's why I thought it was fitting to include it in my trivia today. So that's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan A's Culleton. I hope you enjoyed the show and possibly even learned something about economics and how it affects our world. Now, I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. It's also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy, and on research this week was Stephen Daunt and Simon Keane. Hugo da Silva Scott was on sound. Thanks so much for listening and enjoy the rest of your day. And all ready. I'm looking forward to talking to you next week when we'll be looking at the expectations of Generation Alpha.